Good morning, Your Honors. I'm here on behalf of St. Louis County and the Visitors Convention Bureau to ask you to reverse the judgment below and remand this case for further proceedings and trial. The issue before the court in this case is the constitutionality of a recently passed statute, part of a large act, House Bill 1442, which purports to explain what the prior tax laws were and in effect excludes travel resellers, including the internet travel agencies that are the defendants in this case, from payment, collection and payment of the hotel tax and tourism tax enacted by Missouri statute. We have a number of challenges, and I'd like to start off with the challenge dealing to the fact that the title of this bill is overbroad. And the case, primary case I rely on is the Home Builders Association of Greater St. Louis, decided by this court on bank in 2002. The title here lists, as is typical for all bills, a number of sections that are being repealed, the number of new sections being enacted, and a descriptive phrase. In this case, the descriptive phrase is relating to taxes. And relating to taxes, in the context of this bill, is so broad and amorphous that no one reading the title would really know what the bill involves. In our brief, we discuss a couple of the sections of the bill, which are the furthest extremes of what is enacted here. There's a provision in the bill that authorizes local government units to enter into cooperation agreements with each other and with the federal government. The Attorney General tells you, well, this relates to taxes, because cooperation causes things to be more efficient, you save money, therefore you can get more mileage out of your tax money.
Opposing counsel says for this and the other arguments you raise about the title, clear title and overbreadth and so forth, that they really, assuming they have any validity, they affect other sections and not the section which is applicable here. And therefore, even if the challenge could be correct if someone else raised it, it doesn't really affect this case.
Your Honor, their argument might have merit as respect to the contention that the title of the bill is too narrow, underbreath. When you have an overly narrow title that doesn't describe everything within, you can par off the portions that are outside the scope of the title. But here, this particular challenge is about the overbreath of the title. The title of relating to taxes, in the context of this bill, and as further explained by the Attorney General at page 11 of their brief, is so broad that it can include nearly anything that the General Assembly does. There may be a possibility of writing bills that through their verbal gymnastics they can't bring into the scope of taxes. But they showed us very well on Section 11, for example, cooperation is efficient, less money, therefore more taxes. There's a provision for recreation centers, and it's set up a new form of local government to build these recreation centers, either for a single area. And part of it is, well, they can charge taxes, therefore it's related taxes.
So what is specific? What is sufficiently specific enough? Could it say relating to sales taxes or relating to property taxes or relating to income taxes, or how specific does it have to be?
That's an excellent question, Your Honor. In preparation for oral argument, I did a Google search within the domain of mo.gov to see if there were any bills that had been passed by General Assembly that had just the phrase relating to taxes other than this bill. And my search was Act and the phrase relating to taxes. And I got well over 500 results. The first set of results all deal with this particular bill, HB 1442, the briefs that were filed, the Attorney General's brief. If you go through those, you will find that there is, at least the extent that they're covered by Google, and looked like there's some that went back to like the mid-80s, there's not a single bill passed by the General Assembly that has simply the phrase related taxes. It's all related to local sales taxes. There's some that say taxes for emergency phone systems. There are some property taxes. There's always some kind of limitation phrase in connection with taxes.
And how is that related to, there was a case we had with an EMS district, there was an emergency medical service district, and then I don't think it was a hearing on it, there's an amendment made on the floor to add a carve out for a wildlife preserve in St. Peter's And the same challenge was made that certainly wasn't related to the EMS, a carve-out on TIF. It was a carve-out on tax increment financing, because the owner of that land did not want it to be taken over by the city or by St. Peter's or St. Charles. So that we held that to be okay. What do you remember that?
I recall that case, Your Honor. In that case, the language was relating to emergency services, and right. There was, as you said, the carve off saying that there won't be any TIFs for development on the bottomlands. And the rationale the court used was that the bottomlands area in particular had a problem with emergency services, and that by limiting development in that area, you would limit the burden on emergency services. And that was, you know, a kind of a creative stretch, but it was within a more narrow range than taxes. And if there's two things that are certain in life, it's death and taxes are the one that the General Assembly does, and it covers almost everything.
Mr. Jacobson, to back up just a second,
yes,
your opponent argues that you didn't preserve this constitutional issue that you're raising for our court correctly right now, that was not any part of your pleadings in the lower court proceedings. When your opponent filed the motion to reconsider, did you file any responsive pleading saying that relying upon this particular statute, this new bill, was unconstitutional?
There was a memo filed with the court saying that the bill was unconstitutional and listed four grounds on which it was unconstitutional. Their failure to preserve is based primarily on the retroactive aspect of the statute, which was not enlisted on that. As we discussed in our brief, a motion for reconsideration is a legal nullity under Missouri law. There is no rule providing for it. The two rules in which it's mentioned say you shall not file this.
But although it was filed, you have an opportunity to respond to that motion, don't you?
Well, the requirement as set forth in Meadowbrook Country Club and a bunch of cases coming after that is that you need to file your constitutional issue, quote, the earliest possible moment that good pleading and orderly procedure will admit under the circumstances of the case. I submit to you that a motion for reconsideration, which is not permitted under rules and which is not sufficient to raise anything for appeal itself, is not good pleading.
You know, Counselor, I may tend to agree with you on that, but what about the fact that even when you filed your notice of appeal, you alleged one constitutional ground, but then there are several others in your brief that weren't raised in your notice of appeal? Wouldn't the notice of appeal been a perfect time for you to apprise the opposing party in the court of what your issues and grounds would be for reversal?
Well, the notice of appeal is supposed to set out a basis for why there is jurisdiction in this court. Certainly, I think in your experience, there are hundreds of cases in which the issues that are ultimately briefed are not all laid out in the notice of appeal. The notice of appeal is strictly jurisdictional. I don't believe that there's anything in the rule that requires you to state all the issues you're going to raise.
Does the rule say something about articulating the grounds for your appeal?
Yes, and the grounds for your appeal.
What does that mean?
Well, for a Supreme Court jurisdiction, you have to show either it's an interpretation of a state revenue law. It's one of those. So we articulate that as being a basis.
Does it say the grounds for jurisdiction for the appeal, or does it say grounds for the appeal?
I don't have it in front of me, Your Honor. I don't recall which language it is. I'm sorry.
I guess my thought is what I'm trying to figure out, what limiting language in the rule regarding a notice of appeal leads to the conclusion that you don't have to, that it's just a jurisdictional issue. Most of those cases that deal with jurisdictional deal with the timing of the filing of the notice of appeal as opposed to what the allegations are, the issues raised section.
Well, except for when we were talking about direct appeals to the Supreme Court, because you have to assert what the basis is. And so we asserted interpretation of revenue laws and constitutionality of that particular statute, HB 1442, so in order to show that there is jurisdiction originally here.
When I look at your notice of appeal, it says that that statute violated Article 3, Section 40 of the Missouri Constitution. But then when I get to your brief, you also argue that
it violates
20, 21, 23, and maybe some others that...
Yeah, you're correct, Your Honor. But I would note that there is no response to be filed to a notice of appeal. There is no ruling to be done by any court in response to a notice of appeal unless it's facially on its face that you haven't got jurisdiction. So as far as the orderly procedure, orderly process of an appeal, There's nothing there for anyone to respond to. So in no way has the fundamental purposes, the reasons for having the early disclosure of constitutional claims, they're not implicated by the notice of appeal. And the brief came out. The brief laid out all the issues, giving them fair notice of what the issues were. They had a full opportunity to brief it back. As you may recall, the statute in question only became effective roughly 8 days before the court dismissed our petition. On, I believe, August 30th, and we were dismissed on the 8th.
Was it a basis for the dismissal of the court?
Well, we know that prior to that bill being enacted, the court had denied the defendant's motion to dismiss. The court gave no reason for its dismissal. I would note that there were four separate constitutional grounds mentioned in that memo filed in response to the motion for reconsideration.
Is that memo in the legal file?
Yes, it is, Your Honor.
Are any of those grounds raised here now, those four grounds?
Yes, the single title, same purpose.
Those were all raised below.
Yes.
That. It's just the retroactivity. That
Correct, Your Honor.
And what is your basis for, speaking of the statute and what was passed, I know it says the legislature thinks it's clarifying the earlier statute, but what do you base the premise of your argument that the legislature intended or has any authority to apply it retroactively, that it's suggesting it would actually change the result of prior tax years?
We have the analysis very long, you can see that the new act, Section 1, the one at the tail end of the thing, completely reverses instead of a tax.
So I understand money, the yeah. change. I mean, assuming you're correct in what the first one meant, but whether it's a change or the same, I don't see anything in the statute that purports to say any cases, any taxes owed, or any cases determined under prior law now are determined differently, or any taxing returns filed under prior law now, you owe taxes where you didn't before. It's going forward and it's saying it's clarifying, and this court may need to decide if it really is clarifying or changing, but I don't see the retrospective, any attempt to make it retrospective.
Well, Your Honor, under your analysis that you just stated, the judgment should be reversed and sent back for taxes up to the effective date of the enactment.
So what was covered by the judgment? It was past taxes and future taxes, or was it the
everything?
Exactly.
Everything.
For years?
Going back 5 years from the date of suit being filed.
Okay.
So the suit was filed, I believe, in 2009, so going back to 2004. And the court dismissed that, eliminating
past taxes. It was over taxes owed before the new statute.
Yes.
Totally. Okay.
And it would have covered taxes afterwards. We're not suggesting under the argument that was claimed to be waived that the taxes going forward. We are claiming under the overbreath title that the entire act should be done, and therefore we would be entitled to taxes going forward as well for the county. I'm into my time, so I'll save a minute for a rebuttal. Thank you very much.
Very good.
May it please the court. I'd like to begin with the question about waiver on the retroactivity issue. The fact is that this court has an extremely well-developed body of law that states that a party is obligated to raise a constitutional challenge at the first time that good process and procedure and good pleading make it available. And in this case, in response to the motion to reconsider, that was and citation of supplemental authority that the respondents filed, the plaintiff did file an opposition. It's found in the legal file at page 153. And what that response states is that the change eviscerates plaintiff's claims, that's a quote from the plaintiff's own pleading, but that they reserve the right to challenge the original purpose, single subject, and clear title requirements of the Constitution.
But what is there anything, I mean, since the motion for reconsideration really has no formal status under Missouri law, there's no such thing as that, wouldn't it go beyond our current case law to say in response to a non-approved motion you have to raise constitutional issues?
If you look at what Judge Kintz actually did in his order, and this is at the legal file on 155, he did not grant a motion, just grant a motion to reconsider and dismiss the case. What Judge Kent's his order at 155 states is that they have had this hearing, granted the motion to reconsider, and then the last sentence states, accordingly, the court grants defendant's motion to dismiss the entire case with prejudice. And so what Judge Kent's was extremely careful to do is to decide that motion to dismiss explicitly there. And so he did it in the context of a motion that is recognized. And if you look at the two cases that the plaintiffs cite...
But you're saying he had to raise it in response to the motion for reconsideration. The court said it granted the motion to dismiss, of course, because that's what you're asking it to reconsider.
I believe that there are two... First off, there is case law that states that a party doesn't have to respond to a motion to dismiss for failure to state a claim. And there is also case law that states that a party must raise constitutional questions at the first opportunity. I believe that those provisions are entirely reconcilable because what they say is that if you have a motion to dismiss for failure to state a claim, you don't have to respond to that unless you're subject to the constitutional rule that you have to raise constitutional provisions at the first opportunity. And so what's important for this case is that they had the chance to respond to it because this court's cases like City of Chesterfield absolutely say that if you have the chance to raise a constitutional question, you have to. And so we would submit that the right question to ask them is, could you have raised it, not would you have been required to file a response in
right.
the event that this didn't raise a constitutional question.
Can I also ask you to address the notice of appeal issue? Because I noticed in your brief you didn't cite any cases saying you have to raise these kind of things in the notice of appeal. And looking at the annotations to Rule 8108, all the rejections of notices of appeal seem to be courts look to see whether they correctly identify the judgment which is being appealed from. I don't see any case that has said a notice of appeal failed to raise a particular argument, we won't consider it. It's did you appeal from the right judgment, and if you didn't specify a particular earlier judgment on some parts of the case, then we won't consider that on appeal.
Right, and I think that this the proper way to analyze this is in the same way, because we are in a area of law that the court in City of Chesterfield and the other cases we cite say that if you have the chance to raise a constitutional question, you have to raise it at the first time. And here at legal file 159, they do say that the basis of the court's jurisdiction.
But they did appeal the judgment, and that's all that the cases seem to require is you get the right judgment in the notice of appeal, and we find it adequate. They don't say you have to, and they did appeal the judgment, which they're now claiming is unconstitutional.
And I think that those other cases that are under Rule 81 are cases that don't present where the defense to the case is a challenge to the constitutionality of the statute, because once again, if your notice of appeal in your basis of Supreme Court jurisdiction, because we didn't go to the Eastern District Court of Appeals here, is a constitutional challenge, I believe that this court's case law that says that you have to raise it at the first available opportunity and state and say the specific provision, both of which are in that COD case.
That would be a first impression case, though. No case has said that for the notice of appeal as of this date.
I don't
understand your argument
that.
Why it should.
And the extension of that could be a very slippery slope, couldn't it? No one to this point thinks things have to be raised in a notice of appeal to be preserved.
I don't believe that it would be a slippery slope because the court is so clearly telling litigants at all stages that if you're going to raise a constitutional question, you have to do it at the first chance.
It's a pretty short time period and you're just giving notice that you're appealing the case. To impose upon lawyers the obligation of knowing all of their claims at that stage of the proceeding could place them at a significant disadvantage.
If the court were concerned about the timing in that circumstance, the basis for decision that would be appropriate in our case would then be the fact that we filed our motion citing supplemental authority in the context of our motion to dismiss and then also captioned it in a motion to reconsider. They then actually affirmatively filed a response to that brief where they didn't raise any of that. And I think that the court could uphold its basic principle that I think is important to it, that you raise these issues so that a judge like Judge Kintz or even Judge Ross, who entered the judgment, would have a chance to look at these constitutional questions. And so you could hold that it was waived because they opted to file a response to our supplemental authority notice and to our motion and not reach that question at all.
They didn't raise a ground that they could have raised in that response.
Is there anything retroactive about the statute? Do you read it as retroactively changing the meaning of the – I understand you disagree on what the prior statute means, but
right.
Do you see it as trying to retroactively change the meaning of the earlier statute?
We see it as the General Assembly stated that it was simply clarifying the prior law and so that it would not be retroactive, except in the sense that it might guide the court, because we do have a co-equal branch of government who adopts laws saying that this isn't a change, it's intended as a clarification.
Because often when you change a statute, this court will assume you were intending to make a change, and so they're clarifying that they were not trying to do that.
Right, and they were trying to clarify what they had done before, and so we would say that what the General Assembly has done is explained that we didn't owe this tax at any point in time, and we definitely don't owe it into the future. And so we don't see it as retroactively changing any liability such that it would violate 39.5, Article 3, Section 39.5 of the Constitution, which states that the legislature can't change a known liability or extinguish a liability.
Is that the only constitutional argument that you're saying is not preserved, the retroactivity?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
It is the only one we're saying not preserved, because at the other pleading that they filed did raise the title, subject, and purpose provisions of the Act.
In terms of the new statute, I want to make sure that I understand the range of relief that's available in this lawsuit. If we were to find that the original statute only taxed owners and operators, then it would be your position that there would be no tax liability at all.
That's right.
If we were to find that it did tax anyone who collected monies for the rental of hotel rooms, and that it was then changed by statute, tax would be owed up until the time of the statute, but not thereafter.
I don't believe that the legislator attempted to change what the law
I understand that's not your position, but another option for the court in finding is that they did intend to levy a tax on any amounts collected for rental of rooms, but then the legislature changed that, and so that would be an end date. And then the last option would be if the county were to prevail on the unconstitutionality of the new legislation, then tax would continue to be owed.
So
we have really three possible results here.
I would hate to add a fourth, but you could declare declare that the law was under-inclusive or added subject, but you would find that the core subject was covered by what the legislature did here, and therefore you would say that, well, certain provisions might be severable from the Act. This one's okay.
Yeah.
But those are the, I think, the sequences.
And then that one would depend. If that's what it did, then we're back to prospective taxation and or retrospective taxation, but not prospective taxation.
That's right, Your Honor.
Is there a difference between where the person going through Orbitz or Expedia or whatever actually paid in advance to Orbitz or Expedia versus those who made the reservation through them at perhaps a higher price but actually paid the hotel when they got there?
I don't think that there's anything in the record that would distinguish between those two, and I believe that the way that the contracts between Orbitz, for example, and the hotels are set up is that the credit card transaction does go through the online travel company, and then the room portion is paid to the hotel. The hotel pays taxes on that, and then Travelocity or Orbitz takes their internet fee or their access fee.
And that's true even when you pay at the hotel as opposed to in advance.
That's when you would pay at the I believe that most of these companies would have you pay into the on the internet.
Trust me,
at
there's
time.
A mix.
I'm sorry.
They do both. Trust
right.
me, having
yeah.
used them many
gotcha.
Times.
Gotcha. I don't believe that would be a meaningful distinction for our purposes, because we believe that the statutes are clear that what you're paying the tax on is the rental of the room, and that the arrangements with the online people are clear that the room payments go to the hotels, and then the marketing and internet fee goes to the online travel companies, and that given that we're in a tax world, which means that the taxpayer gets the benefit of any ambiguity in the statute, these statutes definitely do not clearly impose it on the online travel company. And so when you look at the overall structure of the Act, which includes a lien provision that says that if the lien is on the owner, which includes a tax return requirement that is clearly on the operator and owner of the hotels, and that talks about charges for rooms being the subject of the tax, that in that context, when you look at a law that has to be construed in our favor as the taxpayer, that the law doesn't clearly and unambiguously impose the tax. And here we're in the situation where the challenge is under Title Article 3, Section 39.5, which actually requires not just that if you looked at this in the first instance, would the tax apply or not apply, the constitutional challenge requires it to clearly and unambiguously, undoubtedly impose tax liability on us in order for this constitutional challenge to succeed. And so we have essentially the benefit of the doubt in our favor. This is not an exemption.
I'm sorry. This kind of goes along with your argument. It seems like you could read the first couple of the ordinances to impose the tax simply upon any amounts paid for these hotel rooms. But then later it does clearly say that the person who's responsible for filing the return is the owner-operator. Do you have any similar statutes that said because the tax is imposed at one point, but the person who is filing the return may not have received all those revenues, that then they are not responsible for including or going back to the internet people to get that money to file a proper return?
I didn't find
Has anybody dealt with that, where you have a disassociation of those who are supposed to report relative to those who might have collected the full amounts?
I don't have a case like that, Your Honor, and what we would fall back on would be
they use it as an interpretation of the former.
Yeah. Right, and especially under the court's case law that states that you can't view these provisions, even in an ordinance, in isolation, and you have to look at it overall to determine the intent. I would point out to you the hotel and motel tax ordinance is on page A4 of the short appendix that was filed. And what we think is the really key language there, even in the one that imposes the tax that Mr. Chief Justice was just talking about, talks about leveling the tax within the boundaries of St. Louis County for all sleeping rooms paid by transient guests in motels situated within St. Louis County. And in that, we have those three provisions that we think show that we should win this, even as a matter of first impression, without the overlay of the if it being construed in our favor, because they don't pay us for sleeping rooms. Then it goes on, however, to very clearly impose the lien requirement and the tax return requirement. And the St. Louis County tax return, they've never even assessed a tax
against
us. Of course,
in the real problem with that first statute, it says a tax of 3.5% on the amount of sales or charges for all sleeping rooms. The tax is imposed upon sales or charges, which is it seems to imply anything at all. That's fairly broad language.
Well, it would be if you didn't. We would contend you should keep reading for all sleeping rooms because we would view the sleeping room charge as that which goes to the hotel. And the hotels are paying the tax. I mean, this is only about the 3.5% of the marketing or the contract fee between us and them. Mm-hmm. And so we would contend that if you were construing this in our favor, strictly against the taxing authority, and it states the amount of sales for all sleeping rooms, you would say, okay, what of the $150 is for the sleeping room, and that's what the tax is on?
But if you're the purchaser, it's all for the sleeping room. I mean, you know, as a purchaser of a hotel room on the internet, I don't care how you divide the money. You say $150, I charge $150 on my credit card and get a sleeping room. I don't care that you get 3% and the owner operator gets some percent.
Well, that sentence does not. It talks about all sleep for the. Paid by the transient guest actually follows the sleeping room's provision. So it's not the amount of sales or charges paid by transient guests, you know, associated with sleeping rooms. It talks about sleeping rooms first and then talks about how the payments by the guests have to be related to that. And so we would contend that at a minimum in the 39-5 world, which we're in, which is that it has to undoubtedly impose
the tax. It's got to be clearer than that.
It does. All you have to do is
not even good enough for government work.
Not even good enough for government work. Believe it or not, this is one of the few places, perhaps, that the citizen gets the benefit of the doubt, because this is not a tax exception. Yeah. This is a tax that is imposed on us.
And none of these processors paid the tax, or none of the travel agents?
That's the allegation of the complaint. We did not get into any discovery related to who paid it, but that's certainly what the basis of the court's decision was, the truth of the allegation you just stated.
And no estimate about what the amount of the tax is in aggregate?
No, it would be whatever 3.5% of whatever the percentage is of that in there, and that never made it into the motion to dismiss record. Any further questions from the court? Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. First, I agree with the statement that none of the other constitutional claims were waived. And so the overbreath claim is live and vital and sufficient to reverse by itself.
Mr. Jacobson,
yes,
do you need the constitutional claim of ex post facto type application of that statute, or is it just the way statutes work? I mean, there is a taxation up to this point, and then that statute amends further, and it's just a question of statutory construction.
Your Honor, I think that there's two ways that can go. One is that either the case is reversed simply in order to allow us to go forward with the taxes that were accrued and owing prior to the effective date of the statute, or alternatively, reverse it and allow us to get that and the forward-going taxes if you find this provision.
Okay, so for forward-going taxes, you would need the constitutional issue.
Of 39.5, yes, for forward-going, or under the overbreath, then the entire act is out, and then again for forward-going. So I think there's going to be should be reversal either way. My preference, obviously, is reversal for both past and future. Because
what about the argument that on the constitutional application of some of these statutes, we look at it relative to that which is complained of? And if it is not a constitutional issue as to past taxes, then that would not invalidate the forward taxes.
Well, the claim that the statute is written and says that we're clarifying. And the evident purpose of that is to try to undo the tax, the past taxes, as a way of trying to circumvent the 39.5.
Or is it just to clarify?
Well, it doesn't. I think if you read the statute fairly, you have the prior taxes on the amounts that are paid by the guest. The person who is responsible for paying is the person who receives the money from the guest. And under the amendment, the tax is on the amount that's received by the hotel, and it's only the hotel that's responsible to pay it. That's quite a big disparagement.
Oh, yeah, but different issue as to whether it's retroactive is my point. I mean, it can be clarifying, it can be changing. That I just don't see how that makes it retroactive.
Well, if it's clarifying it, then the notion is that it's clarifying what it always meant.
Whatever the legislature thought it meant, whether it thought it was changing it or whether it thought it was keeping it the same and writing it more clearly, they didn't say, and courts are required to reinterpret prior cases or reinterpret prior tax years. There was no attempt. There was simply.
I would be very happy, Your Honor, if you were to conclude. I'd be very happy if the court would conclude that it does not, in fact, change what the taxes were before, and then we can go forward and get the past taxes. But I think that whenever you say there's a clarification, what the implication is that's what the statute always meant. And so if we're able to show, as I think we did in our appeal, that in fact the statute didn't always mean that, and that this is a change, and it is a retroactive change, it's a change of taxes that had accrued and were fixed in amount at that point, and therefore violates 39.5. And that's my time. I ask for reversal for the grounds stated in the brief and argument, and appreciate the court's time.
Thank you. The case is taken under submission.